This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Blitz is defined as a sudden savage attack. It is indeed all this. The effect is sure. The premise is simple. It's a basic primal confrontation. Man to man. No excuses are offered. None accepted.
Welcome to the latest edition of Longhorns247.com.
Looks like a radio station.
Now, here are your hosts, lifetime Longhorn Rod Babers.
Pure athlete, yeah.
A transcend race, hombre.
Matt Butler.
I don't talk man. I back it up.
And we are chock full of that, man.
Damn right.
And Jeff Howe.
It's still real to me, damn it.
And that's the bottom line, because Stone Cold said so.
If you're going to blitz, come strong, but don't come at all.
We are coming strong as the college football season has come to a close. LSU, the team that we saw at DKR in September, is your national champion. Texas, gentlemen, does finish ranked in the top 25, number 25 in the AP poll. So I know that's not what everybody wanted at the beginning of the season, but hey, small victories. This is only the third time in the decade of the 20-teens, as I guess we can call it, the Texas finishes ranked in the final AP poll. And it's the first time since Mack Brown's run of 12 straight rankings in final AP polls that Texas has ended consecutive seasons ranked in the AP poll.
Baby steps.
You read my mind. I was thinking, Bill Murray.
Yeah, baby steps.
So we'll talk about the LSU National Championship, how that ties into Texas, look at some coaching staff stuff. All of that in this latest edition of Longhorn Blitz with Horns 24/7. I am Jeff Howe. Let me bring in the rest of the team that's going to take this ride with me. And everybody, thank you guys so much for downloading, listening, subscribing, however you're doing it, wherever you're doing it. Thank you so much for supporting Longhorn Blitz. He is the master of the soundboard, the drop machine extraordinaire, Matt Butler. How are you, sir?
Doing pretty well. How about yourself?
You're already looking at those lines for next year, trying to get some of them futures bets?
Not really. I saw the futures odds on a few things in Texas, right where Texas was last year. It's like 25-1, like top eight. Same. Texas and LSU were both right at 25-1. It was like the tipping point of that game, and they flew up after that.
Yeah, I have seen I saw the Caesars odds at Texas 25-1. I haven't seen the Heisman odds for Sam Ellinger, but whatever those come out, or if they're out already, he will be in that mix. And as Matt looks that up, a man who he's got plenty of research because he was shuffling his papers before we started the show. I don't know how he stays organized.
Doing research right now, actually.
But he manages to do it. Lifetime Longhorn, 2002 UT All-American, 2002 semifinalist for the Jim Thorpe Award, fourth round draft choice of the New York Giants in 2003, spent his NFL career with the Giants, Lions, Bears, Bucks, Broncos, and a year with the Hamilton Tiger Cats in the CFL. When he was done with football, he got himself back to Austin, Texas in the 40 acres where he earned his degree. Whenever he gets that T-ring back in, I promise I will make sure he wears it proudly. Nevertheless, he is a card-carrying member of DBU, and when you get that All-American honor recognized by the NCAA, they give you that black card, number 21 in your program, number one in your hearts. Mr. Rod Babers.
Thanks for the intro, brother, as always.
So, Rod, can we finally
get some pep in my step?
Can we finally close this decade out and be done with it?
Yeah, officially, it's done, baby. 2020. Let's start fresh, new. Well, not entirely new, but mostly new coaching staff for Texas. And as you pointed out, at least you ended the last decade on it's not an ultimate high, but a bit of a high considering recent events here on the 40 Acres.
So, beats the alternative.
Yeah, no, you beat Utah, which was, one of the better teams in the country. And now hopefully this reinvention of Texas football can have a similar result to the reinvention of LSU football. Which there are a lot of lessons that I think Longhorn fans can be optimistic about. Now, obviously, you'll be hoping that the best possible case scenario happens. But, I remember LSU not too long ago was having similar discussions about LSU football. Not that they're where Texas is at all, but in terms of the transformation of LSU football, when are they going to take the next step?
Yep.
They were in a sense, in their eyes, they were kind of mired in mediocrity because they couldn't beat Bama. they couldn't get over the hump. Yes, of course, they were could be a 9 or 10 win program year after year, but they wanted to take the next step. That was hard for them. They brought in Joe Brady. Ed Orgeron evolved as a coach. We're looking for Tom Herman to evolve as a head coach. A lot of people would have said Tom Herman was the better coach a year ago and not Ed Orgeron.
LSU wanted him.
Exactly.
Over Ed.
But Ed O, he evolved. All right, yep. He evolved real time. We watched him evolve, all mm-hmm. right? And now he went from being a coach with that, you know, now he's considered kind of a lovable character. But before he was a caricature.
Yes.
You know, and people were making fun of him.
Mm-hmm.
Because
he was more of a water boy coach.
USC didn't want to hire him because he sounded all Cajun and everything. Now it's like, oh, that's just a little lovable thing about him. We like it because he's successful. Success mm-hmm. will change the perception of everything you do. Tom Herman giving the double bird and headbutting players. If you're winning games, you know what people are going to say? It's a player's coach. So that's what he is.
Matt Brown went from soft to presidential.
When you won that game versus Missouri and you was grabbing, I don't know what the hell, securing the bag, whatever the hell it was, you won. So people were like, you know what? The players were united by that move. The players liked the move. Hell, I remember even Missouri at the time, their players saying, you know, if our coach had done that, we'd have followed our coach. People looked at it differently because you were winning. Winning changes everything. People won't look at – now people look at you as a loser, Tom. I'm like, oh, man. God, look what the loser's doing, headbutting players, giving the double bird. That guy doesn't know what the hell he's doing. If you were winning, they'd be saying, man, he's a bit of a renegade as a coach. He's out there, you know what I mean? He's doing things. He's doing it his own way. He's forging his own path. Nobody's ever done it like this at Texas. I mean, you know, they changed the narrative. So all you got to do is win.
Yeah, look at Mack Brown. Baby. The first half of the 2000s, it was Mack Brown can't win. He was either had a soft team or was a loser. But then he was presidential.
He was compared to
our nation's president because of his similarities between the two. And then, like if we're drawing parallels, the way that this decade just played out reminds me of the 90s that I grew up and were confused about. Why was Texas, you know, such a heralded program yet didn't see the success? Like, think about the beginning. Well, you have a coach at the beginning of a decade. They had a big game. Now, theirs was like the Shock the Nation tour. Texas still sort of flashed in not 2000 to 2010. Then right after 2010, falls off a cliff. You have a coach not survive like Charlie did, Makovic did. But then you had a coach get hired. You finished the last two seasons of the decade, like rank, get a little bit of momentum. And you didn't see 2000 to 2005 coming after 98, 99. You hoped it did. But just the idea that you open the decade with hopes, looking as if you could win a championship as Texas was in it in that 2010 game, and then just having that guy fall out and then having to replace a guy real quick and then to quickly give those first couple of years, it's sort of similar to that one. Hey,
there's a couple things I want to piggyback on what both of you guys said. Matt, with you, to me, I know we're talking about decades, so nice kind of 10-year chunks, start of one decade, end of another. But to me, where Texas is right now, it really mirrors kind of where things fell off under Fred Akers and where they looked like they were going to pick up under John Makovic. When you look at losing that Cotton Bowl at the end of the 83 season, which that, Rod, I know you studied it when you were in the program and even look back now, like that 83 defense was freaking insane. It's like one of the best defenses.
Yeah, loaded. Yeah,
really,
it was
one of the greatest defenses in Texas, one of the greatest defenses really in the history of college football.
Yeah.
I think Texas set the – before – I think the draft was still 12 rounds, but in the modern era draft since the merger, Texas does the record. I think 17, 18 guys picked. Most of those guys were off that defense. But they lose that Cotton Bowl to Georgia heartbreaking fashion. They're number one in the country in 84. They have the tie against Oklahoma, then it falls off a cliff. And then really through the end of Fred Akers and then under McWilliams, you had the Shock the Nation year, but they're kind of – nothing ever really seemed right, and it was more
miss than
hit.
That's why the 90s felt like this. It was just a lot of murkiness.
And it's kind of where Texas is now. It's kind of where if you look at the 2019 Texas team, it's kind of almost where that 94 team was under Makovic, where they had some ugly games in 94. There was the loss to Rice. I remember them going out to Texas Tech and losing an ugly game.
Mm-hmm.
But then – they kind of got it together. I remember a Thanksgiving win over Baylor. That seems to ring a bell. And then
they go
to the Sun Bowl and beat North Carolina, coached by Mack Brown.
Yeah.
And then the next year, they're 10-2. They win the conference. They beat A&M in the final Southwest Conference game at Kyle Field. And then they won the first Big 12 title in a year where the record didn't match the expectations going
into
the year.
Another way, the 90s and the 2010s are the same. The Aggies both had the ending of a conference or the ending of a conference.
But it's kind of that same thing where Texas just went through this like 10, 11-year window where it fell off a cliff and you never really got it back all the way back.
Exactly. Yeah.
You just had your flashes like, ooh, this is what – oh, man, look at that. That team – maybe they can be really good this year because they showed some signs of life or they showed some signs of momentum and progress in the year before, but it was never consistent. And, you know, that's the beauty of what Mac Brown did. It was that you say what you want. People were disappointed in just 10 wins at one point because he became a prisoner of his own excellence. But the truth is that was about as consistent a program, a decade for a program, as we've seen in college football history in terms mm-hmm. of just the consistency. I mean, that's what you want, right? Consistently good to be great. That's what Mac used to always say, and that's what he was during that time period. And you're trying to get back there, and obviously you may not be able to make it last a decade. I mean, I don't know if that is realistic. It probably should be. I mean, Ohio State can do it.
In Texas.
Oklahoma has been able to do it.
Saban.
Yeah, and you know, exactly.
Going on
Bama,
the Baker's dozen.
Clemson will probably end up with something like that. It is, you know, I mean, you should be able to do it if you have the right guy, and Texas should be able to get that guy. Hopefully Tom Herman is that guy. But, yeah, man, I'm with you. I think right now it's similar to a lot of those recent examples you guys brought up because you just can't get to consistency. I mean, that Sugar Bowl win, everybody gets high, and then this season – you know, you only get to 7.
It's just like you know, you look you know? In, like I said, in the 80s, like the first under McWilliams, they're 7-5, and maybe you think, okay, it's going somewhere. You get a bowl win, and then it bottoms out. And then you have the Shock the Nation year, and then really starting with that Miami Cotton Bowl. The next year, I think they're 5-6, and McWilliams is fired, and then, the regime changed. But, Rod, I don't want to, like, sit here and wax nostalgia about Mac Brown.
No, I'm not.
And kind of go revisionist history. But to your point just about how successful the decade was, I'm just going to run you down the numbers starting in 2000, go through 2009. Here's your finishes in the final AP poll. 12th, 5th, 6th, 12th, 5th, 1st, 13th, 10th, 4th, 2nd. Your win totals in those years from 2000 to 2009, 9, 11, 11, 10, 11, 13, 10, 10, 12, 13.
And I remember 9, 11, 11, and I remember the disappointment.
Yeah.
Right, because we were that talented. Yeah, we were producing a lot of NFL talent on the 40 acres. You'd see those guys going, well, that's a first round offensive lineman, first round NFL player, first round running back, or first round wide receiver. Why isn't Texas doing more? And you know what? Those are the questions that fans are supposed to be asking at Texas. So I think ultimately getting back to what, you know, the lessons you learn from the national championship game, I think the number one is evolution of the coach.
Right.
I'm hoping we can see that from Tom Herman. Number two is the transcendent transformation, transmogrification of a quarterback. Because we all sat here 6-7 months ago, and we clearly, LSU fans, I talked to plenty of them and said, oh, Sam Ellinger's a better quarterback than Joe Burrow. No question. Like, we all agree with that. You guys have the quarterback advantage there. But, you know, we had disadvantage. And yet now Joe Burrow completed what might have been the greatest college football season in the history of college football for one individual player.
Yep.
And I said, you know, to me, I'll talk about this on my show a little bit, but you know, it is, to me, something Texas needs to be wary of. If he can be to LSU what Vince Young was to Texas, which is what a lot of people are making that kind of comparison with
Hopefully
Tim Tebow was for Florida,
happy.
You know what I mean? Like, it can take that program to another level. You know what I mean? And that's crazy to think because LSU's at a pretty damn good level, but they've never had a season like this where they're the highest scoring team in the history of college football, set all the records, won all these awards.
Beat 7 ranked teams.
They've been
10,
recruiting damn good without that resume. Now they got that resume to add. They're coming into Texas, big things are swinging, and I'm telling you, they coming in to take your best. And Texas needs that very best, those top 15 players in the state, to win a national title. But when Ohio State comes to town, and when LSU now comes to town, and when Bama comes to town, they're coming to take your 5 stars and your 4 stars. They say you can have your 3 stars because you know what? You ain't developed them that well anyway.
And in this league, in the Big 12, those schools with the offenses there, where you look at the offenses at Ohio State, the offense at LSU,
mm-hmm.
now they're starting to take skill guys.
I didn't take any wideouts.
The guys that you need to win in the Big 12.
Yeah, exactly.
Quarterbacks, wide receivers.
At first they were taking just your D lineman and your O lineman. He's like, damn, we can't keep that.
Battles that you knew you were going to lose.
You were losing those guys because they're producing NFL D lineman, O lineman, and you're not. But now, like you said, they're coming in and taking your wideouts and your cornerbacks.
Because you're the Big 12.
And your quarterback. And
you got
now,
the Big 10 and the SEC doing that?
The one thing Texas has, you know, I think the state of Texas has done, I guess, a relatively decent job on is obviously that nobody produces quarterbacks like the state of Texas. Nobody in the history of America has ever done it in the history of the game, whether it be at the college or the pro level. You know, these prolific offenses start coming in here and taking Texas quarterbacks like Mahomes. Yeah. And, hell, even going back to what Tannehill, the guys who are playing in mm-hmm. the AFC title games, come so start taking those guys, the Baker Mayfields and the Kyler Murrays. And, you know, and I know Oklahoma's doing their part, too, to take it from Texas schools, but that is also could be trouble.
Yeah, because, I mean, we talked about the SEC and the Big Ten for the past two decades have been this places you would say are not the offensive forefronts of evolution. This was the one, and now if you have your top guys from the Big 12 leaving to join that, that'd be trouble.
That'd be trouble.
You mentioned the evolution of the coach, Rod, and I think that, to me, is kind of what's one of the things that really stuck with me watching LSU in this run they've been on. And can we stop? Like, I know we haven't done this, but can we stop talking about the relevance of the end result of that Texas-LSU game in September? Yeah. Like, that LSU team in September is not anywhere in the ballpark with where LSU is right now.
No, they're not. No. I agree.
It's still good that happened, but it doesn't have anything to do with what happened this time.
It's almost like, how can I compare the title game? Like, it's almost like playing a game of Mike Tyson's Punch Out and like little Mac just wears himself out and he got a nice lead. And it's like, all right, you finished? Okay, cool. And then LSU just put the hammer down.
Yeah, it was interesting that Ed Orgeron.
Like they flat dominated Clemson.
He gave a shout out to Texas and said,
well, he has
that
every
third
single
and
time.
17. That third and 17, he said, that's when I knew this team could win a national title. I'm not saying you could take that which way you want as a Texas fan, but. It was a big game. It was huge.
It was.
We had talked about how big
game.
It was. And I think both programs went on different paths after that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Strangely enough.
But,
Ed O reiterated that. He talked about that play after the Auburn game, after the Alabama game at Joe Burrow's.
It was big.
It was huge. And
it was
it's worth
because
mentioning
he admitted
that.
After that game, they couldn't stop Texas. If Texas gets that ball back. 3rd and 17, the odds, the success rates are really
We're
low.
Going to overtime.
Can we shelve 3rd and 17 for a minute? Because I want to hit more on that.
No, sorry.
No, it's fine. But the evolution, Rod, you know, you look at Ed Orgeron, you go back to his first year at LSU because he was the interim after Les Miles got fired, you know, was it 4 games into the 16 season? And then they had the coaching search. Are they going to hire Jimbo Fisher? Are they going to get Tom Herman? And they promote Ed Orgeron from interim to full-time coach. And that 2017 season, you get early into that thing, and they had that game where they lost to Troy at home.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, you're wondering, like, man, I don't think Ed Orgeron's going to make it.
That's a good point.
Because at that point, they're 3-2, they're 3-2, getting ready to go on the road to play Florida. And you're like, man,
Good point.
That doesn't look good for Ed Orgeron.
Yeah.
And he managed to just get through that season, and you know they won 10 games last year, and they get Joe Burrow.
That's big, baby.
So they went over the locker room, and that was the big part there.
Yeah,
exactly. And from that standpoint, guys,
LSU. I mean, Les Miles was such a player's coach, and they even rallied to keep him in. So then they wanted to hand it over to a guy that also sort of felt that locker room, and he was able to capitalize.
But and the bigger point to that is Joe Burrow. And from that standpoint, just getting the LSU and stabilizing the quarterback position, he saved Ed Orgeron's job.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And
often quarterbacks do.
Right. and in a lot of ways, Tom Herman has – that's what's allowed him to have the success he's had, which is having a guy, a proven commodity at that position in Sam Ellinger.
Amen.
We're at that exact same stage right now with Sam.
What Tom Herman has to do, though, guys, is the same thing Ed Orgeron did. I wrote this after the Baylor game. Rob, you brought it up earlier, like the headbutting thing. That's really what – I remember, like, I know it wasn't that long ago, but I remember sitting in the press box in Waco and watching that go down, and my first thought was, man, if they don't win this game, that's all we're going to hear about.
That's all you're going to talk about. That's it.
All it's going to be talked about.
Sour Coach Sours.
And not only did they not win, they were pretty much dominant.
Right.
In the game. Yeah.
And now it's like you got your head coach headbutting people, and it's just – the Pandora's box, that thing open.
Exactly.
But I wrote after the game, what Tom Herman's got to do is he's got to stop worrying about bits and gimmicks and really look in the mirror and understand what really needs to change fundamentally with this program, because not everything is right. It's your culture. There's something there that is preventing you from taking the next step. And Ed Orgeron did that. And we talked about it all last summer.
That's a great point.
And we said the big if with LSU was we knew they hired Joe Brady. And, Rod, you kind of cyberstalk Joe Brady. We talked about, look, yes, we understand Joe Brady's good, but if Ed Orgeron's not all in with Joe Brady, it doesn't matter.
And right. I cyberstalked Ed O and found out that he was in love with these analysts.
Yeah, he was. Yeah, he was.
He was like, no, they're changed. You could tell it was a changed offense. He was blown away by modern football.
And that's what Ed Orgeron did, is he said, look, if I want to beat Alabama, if I want to win the SEC and win the college football playoff, I've got to go all in with this because the old way is not working.
Yeah, the way didn't work.
The way Les Miles did it for a decade plus, it wasn't working.
He said, no matter what, I have to find out a way to go to the spread, was his exact quote.
And you know, Gary Patterson, we talked about Gary Patterson did the same thing when he brought in Sonny Cumbie and Doug Meacham, and you had it's not all that different from what LSU had, because TCU always – Gary Patterson's always going to have good defenses.
Yep.
But it's just that lightning in a bottle of Sonny Cumbie and Doug Meacham getting to TCU at the right time where they had good skill guys. You had Trayvon Boykin at quarterback. And really, they're one awful fourth quarter in Waco away from being in the playoff that year.
I agree with you on that.
Like, you can't sit there and look at their body of work and tell me that 2014 TCU team wasn't one of the four best teams in the country.
Yeah.
And that's because Gary Patterson made the same decision that Orgeron did. He's like, if I'm going to thrive in this job, then
he had to evolve.
I have to evolve. I have to change. And that's what Tom Herman Rod has to ask himself. Where do I need to evolve? What needs to change for this thing to take the next step?
And I don't think necessarily any of us can answer that question. We have observations about it because, you know, we've talked about this too. Listen, I was actually texting with some Longhorn players last night because actually after the game, it's crazy, like three or four different guys hit me up and they're like, what do you think about this? You know what I mean? Because you tell they have been watching the game, watching LSU, think to themselves, okay, we played LSU close. Man, what does this mean? Like, and also, how far are we from that? Yeah. Like, are we miles away from that? Because Oklahoma's not even close to that. And we're getting beat by Oklahoma consistently. How far away is Texas from that national championship stage? And that's a reality conversation. And, you know, I basically come to the conclusion that we're not even close. And that's what Tom Herman's got to figure out. The yellow brick road to get to where LSU is now from Texas, from where we are. Mm-hmm. LSU had a different path. They had different issues than Texas has. Texas has been mediocre for like a decade. There are issues there Mac Brown couldn't solve, Charlie Strong couldn't solve, and you have failed to solve in your first two or three years. You know what I mean? Like, there are some deeply systemic issues with Texas football right now. You got to go in and figure out what that is.
Yeah.
And also, a lot of that reflects on you as a coach. You got to do all that introspection and break it down. That's why you're paid the big bucks. That's why you got the advances and the bonuses. And good for you. You deserve it. But if you don't go in and solve this problem, you'll be gone in 2-3 years too. I guarantee you will. I've watched this cycle over and over again. So, getting to your point about Ed Orgeron, he lost to freaking Troy in 2017. Yeah. He had his lows, and he had that man in the mirror moment. Uh-huh. This is for Tom Herman, the man in the mirror moment. We've talked on this podcast for years to try to figure out what the hell is wrong with Texas football. And we've come up with all these theories, but we don't truly know. We thought getting a quarterback would solve all those issues. You got a real quarterback. You got one that can compete at the highest level, an elite quarterback. I saw today Pro Football Focus – well, not yesterday. Pro Football Focus put out Cam Miller, who does a great job with them, that the best quarterbacks in the country versus the Blitz were Trevor Lawrence and right after him, Sam Elliott. Better than Joe Burrow versus the Blitz. Yeah. I'm thinking to myself, well, what the hell that doesn't make sense to me. He should have been better then. Like, you didn't weaponize Sam Ehlinger well enough, and maybe that's part of it too. Maybe you got to figure out how best to weaponize Sam Ehlinger, and that'll lead you to solving the rest of the issues. I actually don't know at this point. I do think there are a lot of deeply – defense is going through the same cycle every 3 years. The offense, we thought Sam Ehlinger would solve all the problems. That did not. Versus elite defenses, we thought you being a play caller would solve the issues. That did not. You got whipped versus elite defenses. So I don't know what's going on.
Well,
I don't know exactly. I don't think it's that drastic. I think it's like Matt Buller always talks about it. You know, it's like chemical compounds, right? Just adding a little bit of this element, a little bit of that element can completely change the chemical, you know what I mean, composition of something and then make it something totally different. Something that once was toxic becomes something that you have to you live to thrive on. And for Tech, it was just adding Joe Brady for LSU. That was simple. They kept everything else. Like, we added Joe Brady. And it was like, well, that's it? Well, then we had Joe Burrow, but then we added Joe Brady, and that was it. And it's like, okay. Well, then for Texas, what's the equivalent of that?
And then what's that the cure-all? Behavior that got you to that point? Because the big thing with Ed O, with him, was looking in. It was an honest self-assessment. And you've talked about it with Texas and Tom Herman and this staff. We've seen just simple things that sort of confused us at time as to you weren't this aware that y'all this was your weakness. It's like if you aren't able to identify your weaknesses and then be able to admit that you have those faults in these areas, and that's what Ed O did. He's like, I don't know offense. He's like, I know defense. I've been coaching defense my whole life. I've never been able to stop that type of offense. And it's dire times. I need to go and admit that I don't know it and go hire the best at doing what I can't do. And everybody's different. There's different weaknesses for every person. And just to get to the point professionally, I mean, Ed O's talked many about his failures at Ole Miss, and even why he didn't get it at USC and how he had to change as a person, his whole way that he approached the players, and just every single element to it is so layered and so deep that there isn't ever going to be one exact thing. But if the coach isn't understanding first his personnel and then honestly assessing what he can do, control, and maximize, and then understanding what he needs to delegate. Like, Mac was a great delegate. He knew to delegate everything, but I can go and I have the resources to be able to find the best in the world. So, but if you aren't being honest with yourself, and like that's where we saw the odd behavior at times from Herman, because we thought he was one type of guy that was like this Mensa dude that was going to scheme us open. We were going to play at the smart, maximize level, and then he wants to be this physical level.
He thought bunch formations versus Utah was something cutting edge.
Yes.
Like, I'm breaking this out. Like, I mean, literally, it was like, we hadn't used bunch formations all year long. This is what Colin Johnson said, but we broke it out versus Utah because that would dictate what coverage they played. It always dictates what coverage they played, Tom Herman. It wasn't just Utah. It would have been everybody. And it's like, getting to your point, it's like, where's the Mensa? That's not Mensa. That's more Meathead.
It's like, did you and see the very first play of the Texans game?
He's got to admit, I'm kind of a Meathead. Yeah. I actually am more of a Meathead than I am Mensa at times for football. And that's
so
fine.
Then delegate.
Nothing wrong with that. Mike Vrabel's a Meathead.
Ed O's the biggest Meathead ever.
Ed O's a Meathead. And they're in the AFC title game, and no one just won the national title. It's okay.
Vrabel said he'll cut his penis
off. But you have to admit you are a Meathead first. Yeah. You cannot stare yourself in the mirror and go, I'm Mensa. I'm Mensa, baby. That's what they call me. Yeah. No. What we call you and perceive you to be is not what you actually are.
And you have to know that.
You got to figure that out. And to your point about Ed O saying, as a D-line coach, the toughest thing for me to stop is a spread offense, so I'm going to it. Bob Stoops did the same damn thing.
Yep.
When he came to Oklahoma, he said, the hardest offense that I've ever went up against is the air raid. I'm taking that dude from Kentucky with the air raid, and I'm bringing it to Oklahoma, and I'm going to see if anybody in the Big 12 can stop the damn offense that I, the best defensive mind in football, couldn't stop.
Yeah.
And by the way, your example for TCU, same thing. Gary Patterson came to the Big 12 and went, damn it, I've been able to stop every offense pretty much in the country that I've ever seen, and I can't stop these air raids. They are whipping my butt.
That's not even the problem with Gary Patterson. It was they were feeling good defenses. They couldn't score. His realization was, if I can't score points, I'm going to get fired.
Well, just like LSU.
But it wouldn't be a big deal if he was stopping those offenses. He wouldn't have cared.
And that's where
Ed
O was last
year. He'd
been
cool with winning those games by 3 points. And he was getting tired of having heart attack specials every week going, holy, I can't score points and I can't stop them. What am I going to do? So he sold his soul to the air raid. Same thing happened with Ed O. So going back to what I said about Tom Herman, dude, why go get a defense that you've been able to manipulate? Why not go get a defensive coordinator who runs the defenses that have given you fits?
Yeah.
And I don't know if he did that or not, or at least go to those concepts, but that's how we go about you being more Meathead than Mensa. I don't necessarily see that. Coaches are problem solvers. That's it. They're like people. You ever watch The Office with Stanley?
Yeah.
Stanley on The Office, he's obsessed with crossword puzzles. Every day he does a crossword puzzle, even at work, right? They essentially, that's what coaches are. Every day they got to get up and solve
routine.
These really complicated problems. Every day. And every day it's a little. That's why Matt Rule's like, day to day, I'll go day to day, I'll figure it out. Because he knows what coaching is. Coaching is getting up every day at 4 in the morning, all right, after probably going to bed at 1 or midnight.
Or
and then getting up
like
every day and just solving little problems. What they're small, then they're big. In the game versus, did you watch the 49ers-Minnesota Vikings game?
Yeah, I did.
I don't
you watch the game? Okay, did you see the first half when basically Minnesota starts picking on the corner Witherspoon,
mm-hmm.
and they basically get a touchdown, 41-yard touchdown, Stephon Diggs on
really
Witherspoon.
Quick.
They went after them four plays in a row. It's the same thing that Clemson, and it happened to Clemson LSU. What did Clemson go after? Who did they go after? They didn't go after Stingley. Who did they go after?
Fulton.
Because we know, here at Longhorn fans, we know Fulton, he's not the number one corner, even though they tell you he is. Mm-hmm. Stingley's the number one corner.
I watched Brennan Eagles roast. Christian Fulton.
Dude, they went after Fulton all day, every day. And the same thing on the other side. LSU went after number 8, I believe it was. All day, every day. Dude, find the weakness and just go get it and force them to over-adapt to deal with it. They scored. Minnesota scored after going after Witherspoon. Like time after time. Went after like four times in a row. He got a PI. Just was getting lit up. They put in Emmanuel Mosley, their backup corner. He had 3 third down tackles. He had another third down stop because they went after him too. And then they figured out, oh, we can't do a damn thing. He had 6 first downs after that. Shano literally went over, all right, to Sella and said, take him out. I'm going to solve this problem right now. Take him out.
Sweep the
leg. Houston Texans put Lonnie Johnson, a rookie cornerback, on Travis Kelce. Travis Kelce had 10 receptions for 132 yards, 3 touchdowns. They never had a plan B. Their plan B was, maybe we're going to double him and put a linebacker on him. It's like, that was your best plan? And then what was the how were you going to solve the problem when Travis Kelce did beat him inevitably, which you should have known was going to happen?
Go solve that problem. Have every problem solved before you get there.
I didn't see enough of that. Why didn't Tom Herman should have been over at Todd Orlando saying, hey, man, listen, our 3-man front sucks. Let's go to the 4-man front. I understand you want to do it, but for us, it'll work better. For our guys, it'll work better. You should just at least put Osai on the line, do this, and then we'll see how it works out. He never did that, but that's part of being a problem solver. You ain't got to go call the plays, your defense coordinator. Go over and say, hey, man, this is a suggestion. I want this done. I'm a CEO. Do it. Let's roll on.
This is where it's funny. I don't want to get too far off on an NFL tangent.
It's all the problem.
Have you seen the clip of when Mike Pettine and Kyle Shanahan were together in Cleveland?
Yes, that's so good.
It's late in the game, and Pettine looks at Shanahan and says, "I want to run the ball." And Shanahan's just giving this look like, "Brian, run it." And then Pettine all
right
of a sudden just says, "Run your best play." And it's like a little bootleg when Brian Hoyer throws a touchdown.
To
I just thought that was hilarious.
Exactly. But Pettine, not a good head coach, and listen, him trying to solve a problem, that was bad.
Right.
And Shannon's like, that's bad, dude.
So the Tom Herman discussion, though, Rod, I think part of his evolution is in this. You mentioned the conversation with Todd Orlando that should have been had. When Tom Herman got the Houston job, he did the same thing like we talked about. He said, "What as an offensive coordinator, what do I hate facing on defense? It's like when you're a 3-man front because that means you've either got extra linebackers or you've got extra DBs on the field.
Yeah.
Don't like it. You have a hybrid edge rusher.
Mm-hmm.
Don't like that because you can make him multiple. It jacks with your protections and everything else. You're multiple in the secondary. It changes your coverages on the fly, makes things confusing for the quarterback. Basically, Todd Orlando had the framework of everything Tom Herman wanted in a defensive coordinator. And I think Tom Herman, if he's guilty of anything, I think it's just putting too much trust in Todd Orlando and waiting till it was too late. He basically, said, you know what, T.O.'s good, he'll figure it out. And when he realized that wasn't going to happen, it was too late.
Yep.
And I think that's why he made the move to fire him, because I think that was part of Tom Herman's reflection. That said, look, if this program was going to get where it needs to get for him to thrive and succeed in this job, it can't be with Todd Orlando as the defensive coordinator.
No.
It just can't. And I think that's part
Not
of
that
him.
Not that he's a bad coordinator either.
But you look at how he's reconstructing the defense now. Goes back to something Matt said. It's knowing your personnel. Where is Texas really deep right now? Really deep on the defensive line.
Mm-hmm.
Not near enough active. And Matt, I'll give you a second to pull up the Football Outsiders numbers for how bad the Texas defensive line was this year. But I think he's looking at the resources saying, you know what, I want more of a true 4-man front. And Chris Ash is going to use – basically, he's going to use Joseph Osai as a stand-up outside linebacker. Not a hybrid guy, but a stand-up edge rusher.
No
and
doubt.
Be more of a true 4-man front and really try to get after people. And
well,
I think that's
– Rod's been
– Right. Basically, he's going to – and I love the quote I used last week, like, you don't train thoroughbreds to run to move backwards.
Yeah, man.
And you're going to be more of a true 4-man front. If there's one thing you could take from the Utah game, not just one thing, but there's a couple things you could take from the Utah game and feel good about going forward, I think it's the fact that, yeah, when you do allow Taquan Graham and Tavondre Sweat and Keandre Coburn, mm-hmm. when you put them in situations where they're allowed to cut loose and go make plays, they can go make plays. They can be disruptive. And I think that's what Tom Herman's saying, and that's part of the mindset now in having two defensive line coaches, a defensive tackles coach and a defensive ends coach, which is how the staff is going to be structured in 2020 and beyond, is I got to get the most out of the talent I got on the defensive line. You got two secondary coaches, two defensive line coaches. Those are two position groups where if you're weak at linebacker, then I'm going to get the most I can out of the defensive line and the most I can out of the secondary, yep. and it'll minimize the issues you've got at linebacker.
Well, that follows what we've been – even the recruiting, right? I mean, you've been getting really deep at defensive back for the last 3 years, really deep at D-line the last 3 years. The way the defenses are set up these days, you minimize the linebacker position for the most part anyway. You're taking hybrids from the secondary and put them in a linebacker depth. So I totally agree. I like you need to develop talent overall. That's been my biggest concern. I say when Texas gets back to developing NFL talent again, that's when Texas will get back to championship contention again. And I'm glad they have two coaches in the secondary and two on the D-line. I think that emphasizes we want to develop this talent. Yes, we're going to teach maybe a more simplified scheme, but these guys are going to be so damn good at it, and their technique's going to be so flawless that they're going to reach their highest achievement level under us. You know
and,
what I mean?
And I'll give you a guy to watch. It's kind of the measuring stick of can Texas develop talent. Just for the next few years. Well, not just not Osai, because I think we've seen the flashes of him.
I know, and if he doesn't get – then we know.
Right, but here, just take this walk with me. T'Vondre Sweat. T'Vondre Sweat was a value three-star recruit. Had some offers early. He had an Alabama offer or whatever. But, you know, not a lot of people were on him. Mm-hmm. Texas evaluated him early, really liked him. He's the kind of guy that 3 or 4 years down the road, if you're doing it right, needs to be an NFL guy.
Agreed.
And why am I hung up on T'Vondre Sweat? Because I talked to Malcolm Roach at the Alamo Bowl. When defensive players were made available, it's like me and Malcolm Roach, that's where you can get like some one-on-ones. And I'm just going down, it's kind of what I do at the bowl games. I kind of go down the young guys. And we're talking about T'Vondre Sweat. And Malcolm Roach told me straight up, he goes, he's the most talented guy in our room.
Wow.
And I said, seriously? He's like, yes. He's like, physically, he's the most gifted, talented guy in that room.
Wow.
So you're telling me
it's a bold statement.
A guy yeah, that's a that athletically kid, gifted yeah. that your senior captain on his way out saying he is the most physically talented guy in the room. Mm. If that guy is not an all Big 12 level player, by the time he's done, you failed.
I agree with that. Amen. No, that's I didn't know that. That's a bold statement by Malcolm Roach.
Yes.
Yeah. No, I'm with you. I agree. I'm looking at all of the guys though. We're looking at where they are now and then where they end up. That's what development is pretty much. I mean, Joseph Asai right now, we just flashed his ceiling and that's a guy, honestly, by the time he leaves, he should be worthy of being defensive player of the year in the Big 12. Like that's what we're kind of, I'm seeing those kind of flashes. I've seen it like 3 or 4 times last year,
and on
last
the
other, season. And if he doesn't, by the time he leaves, I'm telling you.
These corners, Rod, these corners.
Development.
These corners and safeties, they're going into draft eligible years.
Yeah.
Like, you're at the point now where if you want to know how good the staff is at developing talent, Jalen Green, Caden Stearns, B.J. Foster, those guys should have NFL decisions to make after the year.
I agree. Well, but they got to be able to stay healthy first, like, which means you might need to evaluate something else in your program. Because, you know, I'm just throwing it out there.
No,
that's
you're
part
right.
of reach. Trust me, as a guy who it kind of ended my career injuries, and they're not always anything you can control. But if you can control any part of it, you would like to be able to control as much as you can. A lot of guys been injured in that secondary. I can't remember a secondary that was this injured in the history of Texas football ever. They lost almost every starter.
And skill position guys. I mean, outside of Duvernay, you know, your running backs and receivers were banged up. So it was across the whole, you know, team. And when you look overall, like when you were talking earlier about, you know, where Texas is in context, and, you know, if you were to look at, say, LSU in recent years, you know that they have talent, but you maybe didn't see it just being something that could be so overpowering so quickly by a few changes. If you look at Texas, the main difference from what I'm seeing right now or what it reminds me of is sort of the early years of Mac, where your starters could play with anybody, but because of the systemic issues within the program where Texas hasn't had continuity, they haven't had a staff, this will be that first one. We talked about it 2 podcasts ago where you get the 4-year cycle where actually a coach that recruited players can see that senior year come from them, or even like a draft eligible year, because in all the other ones, Mac was gone by that cycle year, Charlie was gone. This is that one where if you can get that type of depth, we already see that there has been talent that can play, and we've seen that ceiling be heightened by Herman, but the consistency isn't there, and a lot of that consistency or injuries, things like that, can quickly expose you if you lack in depth. And if you can finally start to pile up these classes, not have one crater in class to give you that big old bust rate that's going to go and take you down, you may be able to go and finally get to the point where you can survive losing it. Now, you can't survive losing your whole secondary like this year, but it'd be nice if, like, say, your whole secondary in 2002 went down instead of in 99, it would be a lot different.
Yeah, I mean, you'd had Griffin behind me, you had Griffin and Huff. And,
so, like, at that point, you could survive it. So once you get into that, but y'all couldn't have survived that at the beginning of the Mac era because that was a time whenever an injury to you or Jammer could hurt something really big early on.
Very true.
Matt, to your point about minimizing the bus rate, you look at that 2019 class, and you look at the guys that signed and that were on campus at one point. Brew McCoy is already transferred. DeGabriel Floyd's medically retired.
Does Brew count?
Yeah, he's had some bad luck.
But we don't know if Darian Brown's ever going to play.
Yeah.
We don't know if Peter Pudgy's ever going to play. I can't tell you what the deal is with Javon Shepherd right now. He's still in the portal but hasn't found a home.
Good
so
point.
I don't know. Don't count on him being part of the future. Caleb Johnson's transferred out. So
you can't afford to have any players that get on the field not play well.
Yeah,
that
class
isn't trending the way you probably need it to.
That's a great point.
Yeah,
I agree with you.
And not all those are Tom Herman's fault. Like I said,
no, that's,
Darian Brown, Peter Pudgy's medical issues.
He's happy Darian Brown's okay right now.
Brew McCoy.
His medical issues too now, though.
He did,
but apparently he's fine.
Yeah, apparently he's
fine. Yeah, I was like, that was like sad.
He almost never
even counts because
right,
he never got on campus.
But that's what, getting back to Matt's point, that's why, you know, minimizing the bus rate as much as you can, like just those small margins are so important because there are going to be things that are going to happen that you have no control
over.
Now it's
your special
young man gets
and
you
got to get out there and
play. Yeah, you don't know anything about that. You're just hoping that the young man's okay. You're not guys transferring, guys, you know, medically retiring. There are going to be things like that happen naturally, but if you have one class that ended up with a very high bus rate, then another class like 2019 trending that way, that back-to-back could be disastrous.
Yeah,
right.
Bad luck can only magnify your busts. Like, if you have bad luck, and then it just opens up that door to have the magnification of a potential miss. And then if you missed on that guy, well, now you're left with two and you have zero.
No, I totally agree.
And I think if you want kind of a sign that the staff can develop guys, go back and look at that 2017 class, that transition class, because, I mean, Toniel Carter transferred out, and you've had Rob Cummins medically retire. And I guess if you want to count Josh Rowland, he played for 2 years and then grad transferred.
Yeah.
But you got eligibility out of him, and he was your kicker for 1 year.
I would
year.
Say he got some reps. Yeah.
But Sam Ellinger, Taquan Graham, Gary Johnson, Montrell Estelle, Josh Thompson, Reese Leto, Marquez Bimage, Kobe Boyce, Derek Kerstetter, Danny Young, Cade Brewer, Sam Cosmi, Jamari Chisholm.
Yeah.
Like, all those guys except for Chisholm have started at some point.
They've all been at least significant contributors.
That'll get you back to being where Texas should be, that you're right
there
ahead
of
everybody but OU.
For a transition class.
Basically, your only outright busts in that class are Toniel Carter and Jordan Pouncey.
And you can survive that.
Yeah. No, you're right about that.
Because you found a starting quarterback, a starting defensive lineman, an all Big 12 linebacker.
Tight end.
Estelle provides depth at safety. Thompson's going to have a chance to start in a nickel. Mm-hmm. A starting tight end, a starting caliber defensive lineman, a starting caliber corner, another starting offensive lineman, a starting running back, another starting tight end, a potential All-American offensive tackle. Like, that's when you're getting somewhere.
No, I totally agree. You built a lot of your foundation with that class, and that's hard to do with a transition class. So that's a good sign.
The tough one, as you start looking towards spring, the tough one's going to be the 18 class because a lot of these guys that are in their third year.
they're right there on the fence.
It's kind of you know what or get off the toilet
right
for some of these guys. Look, like, you know, Caden Stearns, B.J. Foster, Jalen Green, DeMarvion Overshown, Brennan Eagles,
the
Anthony
DBs,
Cook.
Yeah.
Like those top
the
few guys,
good,
you're fine.
You got NFL guys there.
You've got Joshua Moore's situation. Don't know what's going to happen there. Mm-hmm. It's not 100% clear, although I'm expecting him to be back. Alvante Woodard is a guy that –
wow, Houston Lamar, right?
Lost in the mix, yeah.
Yeah.
And then you go, and then it starts, I'm just going down where they were ranked, and then it starts Deshaun Jameson, Delia Adeyewe, Keandre Coburn, Junior Anguilau, Keontae Ingram, Joseph Osai. Another run of guys that are starting caliber players for you.
We're talking about our upperclassmen foundational classes.
Yeah.
Like, that's a big thing.
You don't know what's going to happen with Malcolm Epps, Cameron Rising transferred, But then Casey Thompson. And then this is the group of guys where you need to start to figure some things out. Casey Thompson, Reese Moore, Rafita Girmay, Moro Ojimo, Byron Vaughns, Daniel Carson, Christian Jones, those type guys.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That group with Alvante Woodard, those probably what I just named four, five, six guys.
Yeah.
Those are the guys that now you need to figure out, okay.
They can be really important, especially a wide receiver. We've been talking about
right.
that with Colin Johnson and Devin Duvernay.
And depth on the offensive line is always important.
Yeah.
And it's time to figure out, okay, can Rafita Girmay be a starting center, or is he a depth guy? Can Christian Jones be a starting right tackle, or is he a depth guy?
That's going to determine your recruiting projections, right, and wants and needs and all that for the 2021.
Because if you're Herb Hand, you might be looking at 21 saying, you know what, I think that some of these guys might grad transfer out or retire or whatever, and I ain't going to recruit me an extra offensive
lineman. Those are the type of guys that sounds like, as you used as an example, Patterson for decades has been able to maximize those guys at this tipping point where you say didn't know them or you hadn't seen production, but then when given the opportunity, they're prepared, ready to go, and you can plug in. And as long as you don't have that horrid bust rate where it falls off or now with the transfer portal when they end up leaving, if you can get those guys where you're sort of wondering, are these guys going to be able to make it, what's going to play out here? And if you can get that satisfactory performance from both of them, it just allows you to be as good as your stars or your leaders.
I would say that in the Big 12, a lot of teams have that. I think Gundy does that really well. I think Patterson does that really well.
Hence why Texas struggled the past decade.
Yeah, I think Matt Campbell's really good at that. Just kind of max it. Like, I'm not going to waste any of this talent I have.
Rule
I
got to maximize.
Rule was really good at it. So yeah, that in Texas
for Bill Snyder.
Just opposed to Texas, it's a pretty stark contrast.
Yes. It's the whole difference in like where Texas is right now.
No question.
I do want to talk about the coaching situation.
Let's do it.
Because we got a little bit of breaking news, but I want to talk about the 3rd and 17. I'm sorry.
We're going to get back to it. I love it.
I have a bad habit of doing that. So, like, well, let's table that and we never get back to it. But I want to talk about 3rd and 17. And it's funny when you look at teams that win championships, you can usually point back to one play, one moment where you said, okay, that's where it kind of the thing turned.
It convinced you, like, oh, yeah.
Like Texas in 2005, the Lima Sweet catch in the corner of the end zone against Ohio State.
Yep.
So when you realize you went up there at the Horseshoe at night, you beat Ohio State, an Ohio State team that was friggin' oozing NFL talent everywhere and beat them, had a future Heisman winner playing quarterback in Troy Smith. That's when I think everybody realized, yeah, okay, now you can start thinking about the big picture.
And thank you, Tressel, for not starting him.
Yes.
Justin Zwick, what the
Troy Smith situation was. But anyway,
he got in trouble in the offseason.
Yeah, when you look at 3rd and 17, I think right it ties in just kind of everything we talked about. I think Texas is closer than they've been in a while to being legitimately in a position where they can take that next step and get into that upper tier. Does that make any sense, what I just said? I know that's hard to follow.
Yeah, but closer than they've been to win the Big 12.
Closer
basically.
Than they've been to in a while to being legit, where you can legitimately say, okay, the next step is
winning the Big 12.
Right.
They haven't done that. Hell, they didn't do it with that mushroom Mackles here. It's hard to do for them.
So that's where the program is. But I think it also tells you, man, that's really how kind of far away you are from being elite, too.
Yeah, I agree, because the Big 12 champion ain't close to LSU.
When you can win that game, and if you don't win the Big 12, it doesn't matter.
Or Clemson.
And then we're talking about developing talent, evolution of the coach, evolution of your scheme. Again, like I said earlier, look at LSU in September and look at them now.
Yeah.
You can't even quantify how much better they are.
Yeah.
That was game two for Joe Burrow in this offense.
Yeah, it's crazy. Yeah. They've gotten better like every week, too, almost. I mean, exponentially better. No, I'm with you.
Yeah, I love when you brought up the stat, though, a second ago or earlier in the show about which quarterbacks were most successful against pressure. It's like Todd Orlando was like, see, I should have just brought it all the blitz to Joe Burrow.
You know, I will say that 3rd and 17 couldn't get to bring it to match point. I will say 3rd and 17. Remember, we talked about that Todd Orlando, his default setting was always, I'm just going to bring pressure. I'm going to bring the blitz, even an all-out blitz. I will say now, looking back in retrospect,
against Burrow, it's right.
I don't know if there's anything you could have did against LSU.
Well, no, 8-man. Did
now
you see
looking
the numbers
back,
against
and now
eight
looking
man
at what
coverage?
Britt Venables and Kevin Steele and Kirby Smart and Nick Saban, looking
Alex
at how
Grinch.
All of them with even more game film than Todd Orlando had. By the way, remember, he didn't have any film. He had like one game to watch. You know, yes. What the hell Joe Brady was going to throw out there. Considering that, I will say now, yeah, I don't know what he could have done. I'm looking at a guy, Joe Burrow, who played the greatest college football season ever in the history of college football, probably for a quarterback. And that the wide receiver, they scored more points than anybody else. They had a Blitnikoff Award winner. I really, maybe that was the right call.
Even in hindsight.
Well, against him it was because I heard the stat last night.
Maybe it was the right call.
Well, did you hear just them talk about how Burrow, I'll get the exact number, but he's something absurd since like the Auburn game against 8-man coverages, and he's like 90%.
Yeah,
I'm not lying.
Freak,
he's 90% against 8 men dropping back.
Yeah, he's just a freak. He's just a freak. Like, he's a freak. He's like VY. What was the big third and long that VY converted? What was the third and what?
No,
Kansas was in
04. 04
was
fourth
and 19. Exactly. Nick Reed had his leg. It was on the stage.
I mean, some guys are just freaks, man. Like, he's a freak. What do you mean to say? Tyler was probably right back smoking a cigar, just
what
like Joe Burrow was going, oh, what y'all got to say now, huh? The guy's a freak, and the system was a freak.
But here's the problem I have with 3rd and 17, and I think this goes back into Tom Herman eventually losing faith in Todd Orlando. The call is not what I have a problem with necessarily. The issue I have with that whole situation is Todd Orlando had in his mind, whatever the situation was,
exactly.
He was running a zero blitz.
For the rest of the year.
And that's not
true.
Knowing your personnel, not knowing the situation, not knowing the opponent. Like, every coaching intuition you have, everything in the coaching booklet that says, this is what you need to know on a third down call, Todd Orlando threw caution to the wind and said, to hell with it. I'm going zero blitz no matter what.
You know,
that's what I have a problem with.
Not giving yourself a chance.
Totally.
I'm just saying, like, at this point, I am now thinking to myself, what would have been more effective? And I'm not sure another tactic would have been that much
and
more
I
effective.
And I think it was the right call on that
is,
play.
Now, you
he
probably
didn't
would,
evolve
I would
his
say
defense
this,
the rest
if
of
you
the
don't
year.
Zero blitz, you probably don't get a touchdown. But we know the game's over, though.
Right.
They get the first down, the game's over.
Right.
You know what I mean? So, it's a great discussion because I thought about it for like 20 minutes last night. I was like, damn, it's pretty. Because
right
I saw
time.
That safe stat Matt was talking about. I was like, he's really good when you drop back 8, but he's also one of the best quarterbacks in college football with these blitz. Well, hell, what do I do?
I think the frustration of 3rd and 17, though, I think it boils down to this. I think if you're a Texas fan, when you look at the body of work of LSU season, Texas had the best chance to beat LSU.
They did
because
they caught them
early. It was the second game of the season.
Mm-hmm.
It's at home.
Got them early.
Yeah. Nobody really had a chance.
I totally agree with you. Yep. And I think that's the disappointing thing if you're Texas because think about it, if you're 8-4 team instead of 75, but your one win was over, then because they probably still would have been the national title even with the one loss to Texas because they'd have won the SEC. In my opinion, they'd still won the SEC and they'd have still went to the
they
national
wouldn't
title.
Have been the number one seed
but
in the
they
playoff.
But they had one loss. And if your one loss was Texas and Texas was an 8, you know what I mean? Sorry.
9-4.
9-4 instead of 8-5. Then, yeah, I think it matters. I think it matters.
Yeah.
It does. Honestly, you may win another game if you win that LSU game. Who knows how, you know, the season shakes out, your confidence level.
Butterfly
what you do.
Effect.
Yeah, like, exactly. You never know what happens
no,
if you
crazy.
Win that game.
Who gets hurt,
that's like
win?
The,
like, literally.
That's one of the biggest games of the season in college football. You win that game, they can completely change the entire season.
B.J. Foster admitted, like, the final Trek trying to chase him down for no reason on 3rd and 17 was when the hamstring popped. Like, that was one of the injuries.
That
like,
was one of the
it was
like,
that's
not funny, by the way.
But it is the
but,
truth.
That's true. That's
but
crazy.
It's things like instead of.
That's why Caden Stearns probably got hurt that play, too.
Well, no, but here's the thing with that, though. It, instead of feeling the need to get back up on the horse the next week, does Tom Herman just treat the Rice game as like anybody that's got any lingering injuries not playing tonight? We'll take our 2s and 3s, and we'll still go trust ourselves to beat Rice by 20.
That's a good point. No, I'm with you. Like I said, it could be any number of things. But I do think you're right. I think everything could be a little bit different. Just the perception of the team is different. If you and remember, we came on this show. And I know we got to get to the coaches thing. We came on this show and said after that game, we thought Tom Herman was being intentionally vanilla. Remember that? I was like,
yes.
That was a theory. It was
too much credit.
It was a great theory. The working theory was by Jeff. He was being intentionally vanilla because he wanted to see straight up can his athletes beat LSU athletes, and he didn't want to reveal anything because he wanted to keep a lot of the his concepts
inventive.
And schemes, keep them secret for the Big 12 season, and that made perfect sense. And then come to find out, nope. Nope, that was just Texas. That was basically one of the that was like one of the apexes, if you will. Like that was the zenith of Texas' offense, actually,
well, and defense. Because we were like, oh well, maybe you know Orlando will do something when he gets to the Big 12.
Utah was better. I don't know if the Texas offense was better versus Utah. Texas offense probably had their best game of the season. Now looking back versus LSU,
yeah, I was more sense of humor. You know what I mean? But basically, what we saw in that LSU game, the vanilla on one side and all blitzing on the other side.
That's
that was
extreme.
Texas for the entire year.
That ain't
that's we team. That we. Should have just left then.
That's true. Yeah. I know.
Said it's kind of in a decade full of what ifs, from Colt McCoy's injury to the David Ash situation to the Jordan Hicks injury in 2012, like all the different what ifs. What if Texas doesn't lose to Kansas and Charlie's what happened to be Charlie's last year?
Like, what if Texas loses to Kansas this year?
Of all the what ifs in the decade, that's just another one to stack on top of it.
That's
true. Other than Colt's injury, that's probably number two.
Yeah, it's the greatest what if. It's a good one. Too many of them.
Let's go ahead and get. I want to talk some of the coaching stuff. Okay. I might dig into more. I might go on the site and dig more into 3rd and 17 and what it means. I think we covered it pretty good right there, but might look back into that. But two hirings that we know of, right, have been finalized and announced. Andre Coleman getting a full-time promotion to wide receivers coach.
Good for him. I heard he's real liked.
Yes, Jay Valai is going to coach corners. And Chip Brown just reported at Hornets 24/7 as we sit and record the show. Coleman Hutzler, a deal is being finalized for him to be
the
linebackers coach and special teams coordinator is what it could look like, because he was a special teams coordinator at South Carolina for Will Muschamp. So, hey, the Muschamp coaching tree coming back into play.
We all for Muschamp. Prodigies are out here.
That's where our meatheadism, if you will, for football comes in.
Speaking of a great meathead, he's a meathead. But, I mean, that's just, you know.
And it was funny watching Nivar, because it was almost as if he was channeling his inner Muschamp on the sidelines, like he was in the all black and he was all
they got him like cussing, like saying you
F you mother effer.
Yes, that's a good
one. It was pure Muschamp.
I will say this: I've heard Andre Coleman. I've heard really good things about him, even going back to his time at K-State with Tyler Lockett. It was like his main guy that he developed, and he's also a great special teams mind too. He was a really good special teams player. He was a good kick returner.
Still
I believe
has the Super Bowl record for longest kickoff return.
Yeah, so he's you need improvement on special teams. So the Andre Coleman thing, what makes me want, you know what? And I like this. Why it took so long? Because he was obviously right there as an offensive analyst for them. You know, people are like, oh, it took them so long to name him as a wide receivers coach. I think they had a process. I think they vetted him. I think they put him at maybe 4th or 5th on their list, and they had some guys ahead of him. And I would like to think this, that they went through a thorough process and went, okay, this guy's unavailable. The Emmett Jones coach from Kansas.
I can tell you on that, I know Tom Herman wanted to hire Emmett Jones.
Exactly.
Emmett Jones would have come to Texas. I just think, and people can talk about money or whatever, I just think the buyout was
prohibitive. What was that, $250,000?
$600,000, I think, is what.
Oh, it was more than I thought it was. Man, that's way more significant than I thought.
That's what Chip reported. Chip reported was $600,000. I'll be honest, I haven't talked to Chip about specifics of it.
No.
I was told the buyout in his new contract at Kansas was.
That makes sense, though, because it was too much.
Yeah, I was told it was in the neighborhood of what a P5 coordinator buyout would be.
Because $250,000 shouldn't be that much as a buyout for Texas, but other schools.
Wasn't Joe Wickline's like $300,000 or something?
Yeah, who's this?
Joe Wickline's.
Oh, was it?
Steve Patterson tried to not pay.
Yeah, so I could understand that, and I'm sure he was higher on the list. And then, of course, that didn't work out. And I would like to think a couple other guys were probably on that list didn't work
Tyron
out.
Carrier's
and then
name
they were like, you know what?
Up.
Coleman is still 4th or 5th on our list. And you know what? He's really good. We've actually got a chance to vet him more, and it'll be more of a seamless transition because he's been here with the guys. He'll probably be able to start out at a higher level in terms of the intimacy and the relationship.
I don't even think he was that low.
He may not have been that low. He may have been 3rd.
I don't think they. You know, Andre Coleman's the kind of guy that, I talked to some people yesterday, and this is kind of what I got on Andre Coleman. Good recruiter. Well, as much of an ace recruiter as you can be at K-State.
I was about to say
where
they don't
value recruiting. Bill Snyder didn't value.
He got some JUCOs.
But it could, if he's at a place like Texas, he should be a really good recruiter. His receivers were always pretty good.
Heard he was a relationship guy.
Yeah, very highly thought.
Guy.
Very highly thought of as
parents
a,
like him.
Right, very highly thought of as a coach, as a technical coach, a coach of the wide receiver position.
Yeah.
Talked to one K-State source who told me he was one of the few guys on that staff. And, again, Bill Snyder didn't value high school recruiting as much as he probably should have, just the way he ran things. But there are some people at K-State thought he was one of the guys that really got after it in recruiting. And the thing that Tom Herman probably likes about him, detail-oriented guy, is the thing that keeps coming up when you talk about Andre Coleman.
Tom Herman needs those kind of guys.
Yeah. And at that position where, again, you lose Colin Johnson, you lose Devin Duvernay,
you're basically starting over. You need a technician because I'm assuming that they're going to be expanding the route tree as well. From I hear about Yursich's offense, he likes to use the wide receivers on the outside a lot more in terms of more expansive route trees for those guys. So, yeah, I mean, I've heard that because he's a technical freak, I mean, in terms of he's obsessed with the details of running a route and the footwork and putting your foot here and the cutting here, that'll be really good for the wide receivers. Because you could say that was sloppy last year. I just don't think they ran a lot of variation of routes last year. Yeah. I think they were pretty simplistic.
As we said, that route tree didn't have a lot of branches on it.
Yeah, and even Devin Duvernay, I love Devin Duvernay. He's not a great route runner. Devin Duvernay is just a freak that gets open. He's not a skilled route runner by any imagination. I don't necessarily think Colin Johnson was. I think he's just a freak that had a huge catch radius.
Catch radius, and then Duvernay has eye-hand coordination. Yeah. Like literally, he has stick-em. He's like Michael Thomas almost.
I would say the art of route running is creating separation, and honestly, I didn't see a lot of separation from route running a lot of the times. It was And they didn't get schemed open a lot of times. That's why Devin Duvernay has such a great highlight reel. Yeah. And that's why Colin Johnson's highlight reel is awesome. Because it's all of them catching footballs right over defenders or one-handed catches with defenders draped on them, contested catches. They should have more LSU wide-open catches where guys are running free. They don't have those because that's being schemed open. And that's also creating the art of separation, which is route running. And I don't think they do those very well.
And you bringing up the outside receivers aspect is big because, you know, every offense should be geared through strengths, but to be really almost out there and just volunteering information, it's like, no, we run it through this guy and we do it and the film says it and we double down and tell you, makes things a little bit more predictive, especially if it isn't a complex route tree or anything involving from it. So just the idea that, we're going to go where the defense dictates and where the open guy is and that type of idea. And if you have strengths on those opposing outside, it really is better because not everybody's built to be the guy that's an inside receiver.
And hopefully it's more positionless football. That's what LSU does a ton of. That means with bunch formations, condensed formations, and sometimes the outside receiver is playing inside the slot like we did see every now and then them do with Colin Johnson. And I think Corby Meekins was the outside receivers coach or inside? Inside?
Inside, yeah.
And then Drew Marriott was outside. Now they've just consolidated that into one wide receiving coach position, and I think that will kind of lend itself to more positionless football.
Yeah, because the rigidity of that really does limit your possibilities. Yeah.
I think, too, the Twitter response from people close to the program regarding Andre Coleman was good. I know Brendan Eagles posted something positive on Twitter that he liked the
players
move.
Like him.
Marcus Washington's dad, I know, was very
parents
pleased
like
with the
him.
Move. So
it's a good move.
Yeah, I mean, and look, believe what you want about the Drew Marriott situation. You know, things needed to change in that room.
Yeah,
and especially in a year where you're kind of starting over, like we said, with losing two of the statistically greatest receivers in the history of the program. It's nice to have a guy that's a good relationship builder that already has that rapport with a lot of guys in that room. Rod, in the time we got left, I want to get your thoughts on the Jay Valai hire because we've talked about in Chris Ash's scheme, assuming he's going to run, he's going to run variations of Tampa 2, which we've seen that kind of take over the league again. Mm-hmm. It's kind of weird how the Tampa 2 is out now in the Big 12. It's back in with that inverted Tampa 2.
I was saying, it's just with a hybrid linebacker. Yeah. That's all it is. Right?
And we know he's going to run some press quarters. But and so we know bottom line in a press quarter stuff, corners and the ability that those guys have to play man coverage because there could be times they get stuck on an island is huge. We knew corners coach was going to be a really important hire.
I agree.
And there's people that really are looking at the Jay Valai hire. Like there seems to be very little in between in terms of fan reaction to
Jay Valai
hire.
Like it or
they either liking things as a great upside hire or they think it's bad.
Yeah.
I look at it like this. This is how I think you could look at it positively. When the NCAA allowed the 10th assistant, a lot of coaches looked at that 10th assistant as, who's a guy that we can put on the field, but really his biggest value is going to be his ability to go recruit off campus.
Okay.
It's going to be his ability to recruit. Yeah. I think that's what Jay Valai is. And I'm not taking anything away from him as a corners coach. I just think it's an unknown. Like, no, he's got the one season coaching at Rutgers. Like, nobody really knows, like, what he's going to do coaching a corner position. But where is he proven at the college level? He's proven himself to be damn good in the recruiting department.
Mm-hmm.
Very highly thought of from his 2 years at Georgia.
Yeah.
Led the way on some of the Texas prospects they recruited. Lewisine, Tommy Bush, guys like that they got in. I know Noah Cain when Georgia was recruiting. Noah Cain, that Jay Valai was big on that. And he's got ties. He's a Colleyville Heritage guy. He's from Euless. So
D-town.
Got ties in the Metroplex. So that's an area where Texas obviously needs to be better in terms of scouting, evaluating everything in terms of recruiting. So I just think if you look at it from that standpoint, if you're down on it, that probably that might make it a little bit easier to stomach. I don't know if it's going to work out. I do know the early returns on Jay Valai. I'm encouraged by what I've heard and encouraged with what I've heard in terms of how he's approached the job in his first few days.
Yeah. No, I'm going to be optimistic about it. I do remember I said I think Texas' biggest issue is development of talent. So I'm a little I'm a little cautious. He's just going to be the assistant to Chris Ash. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know if he's going to be teaching cornerbacks for, say, like his own technique and things. I'm not bringing him in for that. He's teaching the technique that Chris Ash wants him to teach. That's why Chris Ash wants him there, because Chris Ash is like, no, this guy aligns perfectly with my philosophy. He's going to teach what I want him to teach. There's not going to be like, hey, man, if you want to freestyle here, man, you know what? You can do that because you shuffle better than you backpedal. He's like, no. I want a guy to do this, and he's going to teach that.
Right.
And if he's an ace recruiter, that's fantastic. I would just like a guy that's known for developing talent at cornerback, because you have right now some potential, you know, NFL corners in there. And I would like a guy that I know can do that, but I'm not saying he can't. As you point out, that has not been proven yet. That's not on his resume.
It's the unknown. Not yet. It's the unknown.
It's the unknown. And you know what? Maybe Chris Ash already knows that. He's like, watch when this guy gets Texas talent. Watch what he does with it. And hopefully that's the case.
And if you're taking the glass half full view, I think that's how you have to look at it. Again, if you're the glass half empty, that's how I would sell it to you is – don't even just take the coaching side out of it. Just trust it.
Then you're assuming all their hires are flawed.
Right.
Like, heavily flawed.
Look, I'll say that if you know nothing else about Jay Valai, know this. If Kirby Smart trusts you enough that when he's down an assistant coach, that he's going to put you on the road to go recruit.
I agree with you on that, too.
You got some chops.
Yes.
I agree with that. And I will say his time in the NFL, even though I know he was like a quality control guy, the NFL's emphasis is development. The NFL doesn't get acquisition. They got a separate department for that. The NFL's all about development. They don't even, when you come in first, second, third round, fourth round, hell, I think 60% of the NFL is guys who were drafted in a fourth round or lower. Mm-hmm. Like, the NFL's about development. That's why you like those guys that come from the league. Joe Brady's about developing and maximizing talent. They probably had to teach that guy how to recruit. He never had a full-time job, for God's sake. He's probably going to know how to relate to the world. But they know how to develop talent in that league. And I like that background. I like a league background. That's what Stan Drayton, right? League background, because they're all about developing talent.
Yeah, and any Texas fan, if you sit around and be like, Kirby Smart, whatever, it's like, that's Will Muschamp's roommate. Take it up with Will Muschamp.
That's true.
Tell him he doesn't know football.
Hell yeah.
All right, I want to get more into the new hires, Andre Coleman, Jay Valai, Coleman Hustler. Whenever we come back, that probably will be finalized, and we'll see what other staff positions have been finalized when we get back. And if there's any new staff openings, as of right now, the time we're recording this, still haven't heard anything officially on Stan Drayton. Is he going to go to the NFL? Is he going to stay at Texas? So we'll get into all that and much more on next week's show. Matt, thanks for everything, man.
You're more than welcome.
Rod B., appreciate the time and the knowledge.
Anytime, brother, anytime.
I'm Mark Chapman. Welcome to the Planet Premier League podcast. Each week, Cesc Fabregas, Nader Manua, and myself talk all things Premier League.
As a player, you don't have time to talk.
No.
You don't have time to make a plan. You just need to deal with wave after wave after wave.
We watched Coach Carter, and he said, afterwards, the game's just about doing this for your teammates. And I remember looking around halfway through the film, and half the squad was asleep.
Planet Premier League. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
For Matt, for Rod, for everybody at the Austin Radio Network and the Horn 104.9, 101.9 AM 1260, streaming on the Horn app and at hornfm.com, where you can hear Rod B. on the Rodcast each and every weekday from 1 to 3.
Shameless plug.
Thanks to Matt. You can find all of our archives, classic shows, classic interviews on the Longhorn Blitz SoundCloud page.
Yep, just type in Longhorn Blitz.
And thank you guys so much for continuing to support the podcast. Don't forget, search Horns 24/7 Podcast. Anywhere you get your podcasts, you get us, you get State of Recruiting, you get the flagship. That's Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, Spotify. Search Horns 24/7 Podcast to get all of the latest. For the Horn family, for the Horns 24/7 family, I'm Jeff Howe. Thank you so much for downloading and listening, and we will catch you again on the next episode.
You've been listening to Longhorn Blitz with Horns247.com. Remember, for the latest Longhorn news 24/7, visit Horns247.com.
Baseball has begun, which means you need to listen to Fantasy Baseball Today in 5, part of the CBS Sports Podcast Network. Join Scott White, Chris Towers, and me, Frank Sample, every Monday through Saturday as we deliver all of your fantasy baseball needs in just 5 minutes. We'll break down the biggest performers, news, and prospects who could make an impact this season. Make sure to download and follow on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, the Odyssey app, and everywhere else podcasts are found.